guardian.co.uk.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
So, it's Valentine's week. Did you get a card, or are you a lonely heart? If so, how might you go about changing the situation? Might you even stoop to advertising yourself in the columns of a newspaper? Before you wonder if the Books Podcast has deserted literature altogether, rest assured, some of the most bookish people in the land have done just that. So many, in fact, that the London Review of Books has just published a whole volume of them.
My psychotherapist suggested I place this ad. Woman, 43. Not mental. Despite whatever, a fear of open spaces, the colour red, the sound of rain, plastic containers, beards.
Also just out is A Social History of Lonely Hearts Adverts, which we'll be discussing with its author. And if you're one of those lucky people for whom the path of love has indeed run smooth, you may well be lumbered with the consequences. Children. And you may be wondering what on earth to do with them next week during half term. And you're in luck, because the Imperial War Museum in London has mounted a book-based exhibition for children called Once Upon a Wartime.
And here, as I'm looking at a really wonderful bit of movie of horses and soldiers and gun limbers and so on, I'm reminded of the fact that, of course, the book is essentially, it's told by a horse.
So now to those lonely hearts. Valentine's Day traditionally marks the start of spring, the season when a young man's fancy turns to thoughts of love, or so Alfred Lord Tennyson believed. They hadn't invented women yet, you see. So just think how the history of quotation must have been altered if he'd only looked at the lonely hearts column of his local broadsheet. For women as well as men have been advertising for a mate since as early as the 17th century. Yes, but is that literature? It just so happens that the Lonely Hearts advert is the subject of two recent books. Francesca Bowman's A Shapely Ankle Preferred, A History of the Lonely Hearts ad 1695 to 2010, and the wittily named Sexually I'm More of a Switzerland, which collates some of the best ads placed in the London Review of Books. We on The Guardian, of course, have our own Soulmates pages. So we asked Mairead O'Connor, who runs it, into the studio to discuss the literature of the lonely heart with Francesca Bowman, who we tracked down on the phone to Hawaii. But first, Richard Lee went out to ask some passers-by if they would read out some of the very earliest personal ads.
Like a simple Valentine. At night the
gentleman, about 30 years of age, that says he has a very good estate, would willingly match himself to some good young gentlewoman that has a fortune of 3,000 livres or thereabouts, and he will make settlement to content.
A young man about 25 years of age, in a very good trade, and whose father will make him worth 1,000 livres, would willingly embrace a suitable match. He has been brought up a dissenter with his parents and is a sober man.
A worthy, plump, fresh, free and willing widow liveth near the carpenter in Flower and Dean Street, near Spitalfields.
Her evenings are spent in contemplations dictated by nature, which reason cannot obliterate, and her nights are passed in sighs and lamentations. She frequently starts in her sleep and endeavours to embrace the beloved object of her former life, but alas, the phantom vanishes and leaves her in a situation not to be described. The advertiser is sensible. She has said more than many widows would say on such an occasion.
He must never drink above 2 bottles of claret or 1 of port at a sitting, and that but 3 times a week. His education must be liberal and his address captivating. In company, he must pay a constant attention to his spouse and not ogle or intrigue by squints and looks with pert misses who constantly give men encouragement by made-up leers and a manufactured sight. He must love and cherish the woman only he has promised so to do in the sight of heaven. He must never get up after 12 or rise before 9 o'clock. In a word, he must be the very man he ought to be.
I want to ask if you thought any of those would work in the modern era.
Well, they'd certainly have novelty value. It's probably better than saying that I've been on the Machu Picchu walk or some other cliché.
I probably would identify with a few of them.
Do you think they'd work in the modern era?
I think they still do. I think people like to think that the perfect person should be perfect, basically, without them thinking about how they actually perform or who they are.
Well, they're very appropriate for a Valentine's Day. Very quaint.
You think they would still work in these modern days?
Not likely.
I wouldn't think that this is so much difference to what we can experience nowadays, really. Your love will still be in my heart,
in our city by... Francesca, welcome. Those were a few of the early ads from your book. Tell us what made you think of writing about lonely hearts in the first place.
Well, I've always been interested in lonely hearts ads. I mean, I'm that person who does trawl through them in the newspaper over Sunday breakfast. So really, this gave me an excuse to keep doing that without, you know, my husband becoming too alarmed. So when I started looking into it, you know, I got this idea. I found that actually there was this enormously rich body of evidence of lonely hearts ads that had never been looked at before. There, they'd been in the newspaper 300 years ago, and yet they'd never seen the light of day since. And so it occurred to me that this was a really wonderful way of studying, you know, what men look for in a woman, what women look for in a man, and how that's changed or not changed over the past 300 years.
Tell us about the very first ones. Where were they placed, and what sort of people placed them, and who had the brainwave of running them, and why?
Well, the first ones appeared in a London pamphlet in 1695. So really, Lonely Hearts ads emerged just as the first pamphlets, magazines and newspapers emerged. It was this guy called John Horton who put them in this pamphlet that he ran. So he was commercialising matchmaking, just like in John Horton's pamphlet. He put rooms to rent or horses for sale. Really, finding a wife was just another service that Londoners needed. I mean, London was suddenly becoming such a big city with 8,000 rural migrants moving to the big city every year, you know, and all these people were finding it hard to meet people. They were far away from friends and family. They worked very long hours. They didn't know many people. And so they did need a little bit of help to track down someone to marry.
So, in fact, we owe John Horton a lot in the modern media industry, don't we? Because he discovered advertising, basically.
He did. He was really the first to realise that this was a great commercial transaction, but also that advertising was a source of entertainment for people. That's the other thing, that it not only fulfilled a service, but that people would buy your pamphlet or newspaper just to read the adverts.
Now, I'm going to bring Mairead in now. Mairead, you work at the practical end. But before I talk to you, let's hear how Richard's interviewees fared with the more modern ads. Valentine, everybody's asking,
my psychotherapist suggested I place this ad. Woman, 43, not mental, despite whatever, a fear of open spaces, the colour red, the sound of rain, plastic containers, beards, percussionists, birdsong and cornflakes may suggest. Box number 4326.
Who knows what tomorrow will bring? Amateur roadkill / wild mushroom chef living the Hugh Fernley Whittingston dream. Female, 34. It's fairly certain it will be a stray cat in another night of unwanted psychedelic flashes. Thanks for nothing, River Cottage. Also the A405, box number 8979.
The eye said, take me, I'm yours. The thigh said, preoperative, and it's a long waiting list. Why doth thou mock me, O ye gods? Man, 42, box number 0216. Valentine, everybody's asking. The older ones are certainly more about behaviour and how you should conduct yourself in the public sphere, whereas these are much more about, sexually orientated, definitely.
I suppose this is much more about lifestyle. And this one is much more about income and stability, which is all about how the market's been going, really. It's what I consume as an experience and not what I consume as a material good.
The word me or I appears much more in the modern ones.
So there we have the word on the street. Mairead, do you think there is such a thing as lonely hearts literature?
Oh, absolutely. And I think people put as much care and attention into what they write in onto their, whether that's their small newspaper, Lonely Hearts ad, or whether it's a fuller profile that they'll do on the on a website. Well, some people write poems as their profiles, and some people really are just interested in having lots of photos about themselves. I think one of the key differences is that when you're moving online, when you've got space to have a whole profile of yourself, there are things beyond just the words.
Just to fill us in on Soulmates, it appears in the guide on paper, doesn't it? But it also appears online.
Yes, absolutely. Soulmates began purely in the newspaper, in the guide, and also in the Observer. But in recent years, Soulmates as a website has got bigger and bigger, initially starting with people that knew the newspaper and that's where their ads were coming from. But the website has become a place for people beyond just that newspaper reading crowd. So there are some people that aren't even Guardian readers at all. But there's a particular type of person that maybe isn't a Guardian reader themselves, but that's what they're looking for in a partner. And
That's a very interesting point. Francesca, the earliest ads were placed by men. Men, weren't they?
Mostly they were, yes. Certainly the majority of early ads were placed by men. But you know what? There were a surprising number of ads from women, actually, from quite early on. Well, certainly I was surprised. You know, we have this vision that all the women in the 18th century were just sitting at home by their firesides weeping and sewing and waiting for their knight in shining armour to turn up. But certainly the huge majority were from men, which I believe is different to today.
Pretty much half and half. You don't get that from all dating websites, and goodness knows there's a variety of dating websites with very different audiences for them. Soulmates is quite different in that it's very friendly to women, and there's a very equal split. Although you do see quite different approaches from how women use Soulmates from how men use Soulmates. Looking at dating websites reinforces all of your prejudices, because you find that first contact, it's nearly always the men writing to the women, and almost never in reverse. But the profiles themselves, the women put easily as much time and attention into writing the perfect profile for themselves as the men do.
I've been with my husband for, say, 10 years, and so it's probably only in the last 10 years that Lonely Hearts ads have become so mainstream, socially acceptable, a brilliant thing to be doing, that I think 10 years ago that the situation was rather different. But now, of course, they're a wonderful thing, and we all have friends who have met their perfect partner that way.
Now, they were widely spoofed, weren't they, at various points of history?
They were. I mean, certainly in about the 1830s, the joke of that period that was appearing in the newspaper all the time was a group of men would place an ad in, say, the Times, pretending to be some damsel in distress. They'd then, you know, get all the letters that men would send in, hoping to marry this so-called damsel in distress, and then they'd arrange a meeting where the poor man in question would then get mocked and jeered and chased down the street for having, you know, been so ridiculous to dare to reply to a Lonely Hearts ad. And this was a joke that was replayed over and over and over again, really, throughout the 19th century. People seemed to find it endlessly hilarious to dress up as a woman and mock these poor men who all they were doing was trying to find a wife.
Poor lovelorn lads. Now, one of the women that Richard interviewed there made a very smart point, which is that the word me or I appears much more in modern ones.
I thought it was a jolly good point. I think certainly the early ads in the 18th and 19th century, they're very much more about one's circumstances. So they're all about how much money the person has, or where they live, or whether they're a widow or an orphan, or those sort of practical ideas. Whereas today, there's indeed much more of a sense of the individual. It's about, you know, what you look like, or how old you are, or what your hobbies are. Again, the idea of common interests being important for a happy relationship is quite a new innovation that only came in really at the beginning of the 20th century, where people would say, oh, I like playing the piano, or I like reading, or I like travelling.
But there's another point here as well, isn't there, that it offers up a brilliant social document. And your first book, Francesca, was about the pineapple, which fits into the a literature of commodities. We've had cod, obviously, started it all off, but we've also had salt, we've had spices, we've had tea, we've had the lot. Is this the next stage on from that literature of commodities?
you might say that now that we're sort of commodifying and commercializing ourselves in Lonely Hearts ads, when you know in the modern age it's all about sell, we're even now selling ourselves.
The way that you follow the ads through history, you actually are tracing, for example, when you get to the 20th century, when you get to the 60s and 70s, the personal ad actually becomes quite revolutionary, doesn't it? For example, you say that ads began to appear in the gay press before homosexuality was legalised.
Yeah, so you get the first gay ads, the first ads that openly look for perhaps a relationship outside marriage, the first swingers ads. So there's very much a sense of this sexual revolution going on in the personal ads, yeah.
So there's a lovely one. My husband and I wish to meet other attractive couples for broad-minded friendship. Oh, I like that. And then Private Eye in the 70s took a rather Private Eye-ish sort of line, didn't it, with ads from men offering to marry to give somebody British citizenship, which seems a rather odd turn for them to take.
What I couldn't believe was how common those were. Like, when you, as I was sitting in the British Library, trawling through editions of Private Eye, every single edition in the 1970s had sort of three or four ads from men, you know, offering British citizenship. But it was sort of such a mainstream way, apparently, of getting your British passport that was openly done in Private Eye.
In return for money?
Yes.
Would we take ads like that, Mairead?
We work very, very hard to make sure that we don't have things of that nature. There are certainly dating sites that, well, specialise in every niche you can think of and plenty more besides. It's one of the important things about running something like Guardian Soulmates is wanting to sort of maintain a certain tone. And yes, we don't accept profiles from couples seeking other couples, although we do have people that have tried to place things like that. And it's a hard one to think about. You know,
make all those moral judgments when actually you're judging people's love lives, aren't you?
And the thing is not about making the moral judgment, as it were. It's about making sure that for a person coming to look around Soulmates, they know what to expect, I suppose.
So when the Francesca Bowman of 100 years hence studies them to write the new social history of the Lonely Hearts ad, what will they say about where we are?
The clear thing you can see from looking at Guardian Soulmates is people still write. People like to write about themselves and write to other people. I mean, one of the interesting things about online dating is that in some ways it's fundamentally quite old-fashioned in a way, that it's all about writing love letters back and forth. And to see the lengths that people will go to in writing to express themselves is quite amazing. You know, if you're thinking of a world where everybody is sending 140 character Twitter messages back and forth, well, you can look at a Soulmates profile, some of which are several hundreds of words, and see that people definitely do write, and that people view that as being a really important way to express themselves. And I think that's quite timeless.
So Fran, the love letter of the 21st century.
I think they show that we have very high expectations these days in what we look for in a perfect partner. These love letters are indeed very long. So our expectations have raised in the last 100 years about all the different criteria that we want in someone to share our life with. But equally, they're love letters that are looking for marriage.
We're still looking for marriage.
That's what the Soulmates will show today. We're still, after all this time with all the options, we're still looking for marriage.
Except for one person on the front of Sexually I'm More of a Switzerland who says just animal in bed, probably a gnu. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in. Well, for breaking your holiday, Francesca, and for coming in, Mairead.
You're welcome. Valentine, everybody's asking,
why are you leaving the life you knew? Now, from meetings that can bring children into your life to the busy activity of life once they're there, the question today for many parents is, what on earth am I going to do with them next week during half term? When my children were small, one of their favourite rainy day treats was a visit to London's rather off-puttingly named Imperial War Museum. So I was delighted to hear that their latest exhibition has been put together with children in mind. It's called Once Upon a Wartime, and it collects all those classic war stories for children from the 20th century to the present day. Michel Pauly dropped in.
Stand Ferne wollen wir stehen, wie einst die Liebe Marleen. Wie einst die Liebe Marleen.
I'm Jeff Fox. I'm the consultant to this exhibition. Here we are at the moment in the first of essentially five rooms, each one devoted to a particular book. And then there's a sixth room that gathers together lots of other books about the war. The one we're in at the moment, the first one, is about perhaps the most famous of all the books, and that's through the stage play production of it, is Michael Morpurgo's War Horse, set in the First World War. And as I'm looking round now, there are lots of posters and so on about bringing soldiers into the war, paintings which actually were, some of these paintings were part of Michael Morpurgo's inspiration. He characteristically tends to draw four or five things together. And here, as I'm looking at a really wonderful bit of movie, of horses and soldiers and gun limbers and so on in training, I'm reminded of the fact that, of course, the book is essentially, it's told by a horse who's been drafted into the army from the farm it lived on down in Devon. And, of course, the reason it's told by the horse really is because only the horse could tell it, because the horse is captured and changes sides and takes part in cavalry charges and ends up pulling carts for the Germans and then is finally repatriated and indeed rejoins his owner, the lad who's come up from Devon, to look after him in the first place. And with the change from World War I to World War II in the second room, there's a complete change of pace as well, because now we're into Nina Borden's Carrie's War, written, I think, in the early 1970s, and, of course, set far away from the actual battlefield, because Carrie's War is about evacuation, and the children in Carrie's War are taken from their home in London and away, right away into the depths of Wales, and a totally different experience of life, some of it quite harsh, because Mr. Evans, the person with whom they're billeted, is indeed quite a, to their perspective, a cruel and embittered and severe kind of person. We're just looking, actually, at Hepzibah's kitchen. Hepzibah's kitchen is not the house where they were actually billeted, but it was their refuge, really, a lovely country farmhouse. And on the table is a meal laid out exactly as it is in the book, full of tempting-looking tarts and pastries, and cupboards here that the children are invited actually to open. So the legend on the cupboard here says, Hepzibah tells Carrie and Nick a story about the cursed skull, which is kept at Druid's Bottom. That's the house. Open the door if you dare. And when you open the door, sure enough, there inside is the skull. And even if you bend right down to sort of child height, there are little cupboards, and if you open it, there is a little wartime size ration of meat. And inside the next one, we open it up, and there's a good old dark blue bag of sugar and a little pat of butter, which I'm not allowed to touch, entitled National Butter. And I suppose that was probably about a week's ration.
Is it like you imagined it was in the book?
No, I thought it would be much more grander.
And fancy.
And also posh.
As part of the exhibition over there, we saw that the new families got to pick the evacuees they wanted based on, you know, whether they looked healthy or would be able to help with the chores. How would you feel about that?
I would feel that I would have to do everything, because just because they don't really know them, they think they can treat them as slaves.
It'll be a bit frightening because you don't know the people,
and you don't know where your bedroom is, and sometimes you don't hardly feel like talking.
Well, they have sent postcards to their parents, and sometimes they might not get them for some reason, and you don't know if they're going to write you back, and if they don't, you would feel that you're not wanted anymore.
I'd feel kind of worried either they died or they've gone somewhere else.
What the five books do is span the whole of the 20th century. So they begin with War Horse in World War I, and they move through to Carrie's War, set during wartime. And then we've got the Silver Sword and the Machine Gunners. So the Machine Gunners way up in the northeast, Robert Westall's novel. That continues into actual wartime. And then the Silver Sword, of course, that very famous book, concerns refugees wandering around from war-torn Warsaw, making their way eventually to be reunited with their parents in Switzerland. And then the last book brings us almost up to date, and that's Bernard Ashley's Little Soldier. And the little soldier in question is a boy soldier in a particularly brutal African war set in the 1990s.
Well, I'm Bernard Ashley, and I'm the author of Little Soldier. I'm going to read a piece from Little Soldier where Kaninda, who has managed to get himself into cahoots with the rebel army, is going to be tested to see if he can in fact do the job. Colonel Munyakindi couldn't afford to feed anyone who couldn't fight, but age didn't come into it. If you were strong enough to carry an M16 and three belts of bullets round your neck, if you had a dead eye for a target, you could be put up for a recruit. If you could kill, which was the test, set up in a clearing with a Yasulu prisoner tied to a post with a sack over his head. You were given the gun and you had to shoot him dead. Kaninda saw his father and mother in their hot, blood-wet heap on the floor. He saw Gifty where her little body had slid down the wall, his mouth filled with saliva, which tasted of blood. "Weapon!" snapped Sergeant Matu. The M16 was put in Kaninda's arms. It was heavy. "I give the order and you shoot." "Fire!" And within the count of three, Kaninda lifted the weapon, took aim and squeezed at the trigger. The M16 kicked, the sound stunned, the barrel pushed up and to the right, the heel wrenched. But by the way the Yasulu jerked at the post, the first rounds must have hit him. Kaninda kept his finger squeezed. They had to take the weapon off him. As the prisoner stood up straight and pulled the sack off his head himself, the rounds had been blanks. Like the living dead, he walked towards Kaninda. "Good," the rebel leader said. "You eat." And that was the initiation. Kaninda was a rebel soldier.
Can you tell us a bit more about the background to the story?
The background to the story really is my first viewing of images of child soldiers, and it affected me. I just saw these kids, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, marching off with their Kalashnikovs or M16s round their necks. And I thought about my own children and grandchildren and the differences in their lives. The second part of the genesis of the story was the death of a teenager at a school gate in South London. And when that happened, because it was gang-related, I realised that we have clan, gang, tribe, it's everywhere. And so I suddenly realised that I wanted to do this book, and therefore it was a book based on a theme first rather than a character. I wanted to write about tribe.
There's lots in this room to intrigue them. Over your shoulder there I can see a television screen with lots going on. It goes light and dark and there's sound.
These are mirrors, and on the mirrors are etched pictures of a South London estate. And as the room lightens, you see through the mirrors and you see Africa. And so you see Kaninda's journey from his war onto a tribal war on the streets of South London.
Till I hear the bugle, hear the silvery call, carried by the night air, telling one and all, now is the time to meet your girl, to meet your girl, to meet yourself, as once I met Molly, my sweet Lily Marley.
That was Michel Pauly being shown around the Imperial War Museum. Their exhibition, Once Upon a Wartime, is on until October. Another interesting week then, I hope you'll agree. Next week, we'll be dealing with the problems of reconstructing history, whether in the biographies of the great and the good, or in true crime stories. Meanwhile, we've hauled Lindsay Irvine in from the books desk to tell us what we've got to look forward to.
Well, in the Guardian review on Saturday, we're continuing our championing of libraries by publishing the definitive list of the 100 most borrowed books. We're also getting Linton Kwesi Johnson, Jeanette Winterson and Alexander McCall Smith to hymn the virtues of the King James Bible.
Oh, I'm a bit surprised by that. I thought Jeanette Winterson was permanently scarred by her religious upbringing.
Apparently she still enjoys the language.
So tell us about The Observer.
Well, they are running an interview with the historian Niall Ferguson, and Jeff Dyer is reviewing a memoir of homemaking in Wyoming from Annie Prue.
And that's it. Thanks very much for listening. If you don't already subscribe, please do consider doing so, because we've got lots of extra goodies coming up, including our latest book club with Helen Dunmore. For now, though, goodbye from me, Claire Armistead, Lindsay Irvine, and our producer, Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.